Okay, so today we're talking to a guy named Kelly Alcott. So I've known Kelly for a while now, but the crazy thing is I've known Kelly as the gym owner. So he's, all the time I've known him, he's been a gym owner, run a really, really good gym, but he's got out of the gym business. When he gets out of the gym business, I'm like, dude, what are you doing? Well, after talking to Kelly, I realized that this guy has a magnificent entrepreneurial background and just knows how to, A, make money, and how to influence people, and how just to love on people. And he's a wonderful, wonderful human, got a wonderful family, and we're going to talk today to Kelly Alcott. Kelly, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here.
I've known you since before I moved to Birmingham, and then I guess that was 2016, 2017, and then got to know you through owning the gym. So you owned the gym for a long, long time. But as we started preparing to do this thing, I started reading your bio. Bro, you've got a lot of life experience and a lot of just business experience. So where did you grow up? And give me a background, just the general background of you growing up and where.
Well, I was born in Ohio.
Okay.
And moved to Birmingham when I was four. My dad had a business in Birmingham, a business in Ohio.
Okay.
That company was struggling. My dad's marriage was also struggling, and they just kind of made a big move here to Alabama.
Okay.
And so I've been in Alabama the rest of my life since then.
As we're getting ready for this, one of the comments you made was school wasn't your strength. Me neither. I'm a 17 ACT guy. So if school wasn't your strength, what was your strength?
You know, I think I found strength just my grandfather, like watching him. You know, again, my parents were divorced when I was four, so there was a lot of turmoil at that point, a lot of confusion. I was really strong, per se, as a young kid, and when I finally started to get into sports, that was kind of an outlet for me. You know, my dad's also former Marine, so there was, you know, at a young age, it was, you can do anything you put your mind to, you know, that kind of teaching. Right. My strength was my athletic ability, I guess. You know,
that's good though. Like, but here's the thing: sports is a gateway to so many other things. Sports is almost like a cheat code. If you can be good at sports, people think you're good at other things, and they most of the time athletes get the benefit of the doubt, which is totally fine with me because all my family's athletes.
Yeah, I mean, it made me feel confident to go out and excel on the playing field.
Right. So tell me about your dad. What did your dad do? You reference your dad a lot in throughout your whole journey. So tell me, what did he do?
So dad is a former Marine.
Okay.
When I was born, he was in the big equipment business. I barely remember this, but I do remember riding in an 18-wheeler, delivering equipment various places. He rode motorcycles. I thought that was fascinating. And then many businesses after that. You know, I've always kind of tagged along with him when I was younger. He's a lifetime entrepreneur. He's on his fourth marriage.
Okay.
Been engaged five times.
There you
go. Never really had the opportunity to talk marriage and relationships and that kind of thing. It was pretty much always business.
Sure.
And in sports. You know, if I was excelling in sports, he loved to be involved with that, even to the point of where he coached many of my little league teams. So he was involved in those areas.
You talk about the Marines. You get done with high school. Do you go straight into the Marines, or did you do the college thing at all?
So I went to UAB back then it was the quarters system.
I was on quarters. Yeah. Loved it.
I trudged through two quarters.
Okay.
I was just kind of going through the motions. I had a buddy that was in the delayed entry program for the Marines.
Okay.
And just one day, he was like, hey, man, I've got to go down and meet with the recruiter. Why don't you come down here with me? I was like, sure, why not? Went down, talked to the recruiter, Gunnery Sergeant Hubbard. I never forget that guy. Just a strapping, impressive guy with a grenade on his desk. And he talked to me about the Marines. And, you know, I'd always, in my mind, wanted to, like, prove to my dad I could do something really hard like that. So signed up and was gone 30 days later. No delayed entry for me. It was just,
I'm leaving.
Didn't have it on my radar screen, really. Just went down, signed up, and gone.
How long were you in the Marine, like, active? Like, I say active, but, like, how long were you participating in the Marines?
It was a two-year stint for me. I got out a little early.
Okay.
It was when Clinton was president. had a very minor knee injury, but at that point in time, they were making cutbacks. And they,
if you had anything wrong, they let you go.
Pretty much.
A lot of what you've done has been business, whether it be the gyms, whether it be software businesses. We'll get into that in a minute. But like, what did the Marines teach you? Did the Marines teach you anything about business?
Well, I think the Marines teach you that you can do a lot more than what your mind says you can do.
For sure.
I think the biggest thing that I got out of the Marine Corps, though, being a lily white kid from Vestavia, was that everybody bleeds the same color and we're all equal. And, you know, a lot of the misconceptions that I may have had in my mind were washed away while I was in the Marines. Mm. I learned that, you know, I loved all my brothers, white, black, didn't matter. I think one of my biggest takeaways.
That's awesome. So you get out of the Marines early and you're still young. So you're probably 20 years old, 21 years old, and you start working for your dad. So what is your dad doing and what are you doing for your dad?
So dad's in the commercial waterproofing business at that point in time.
Okay, so let me, I read that in the stuff. What does that mean? What is commercial waterproofing?
I'll just give you an example.
Yeah.
One of the projects was Bryant-Denny Stadium. So they went in, they took all the seats out.
Okay.
Repaired all the concrete, redid all the expansion joints, put down an elastomeric coating, and put all the seats back in.
That is an example of the waterproofing business.
Okay. Waterproofing on a commercial scale is very different than residential. A lot of most people think that, you know, it's the black tar or the interior drain systems, but commercial waterproofing is where you go out and you see swing stages hanging on the sides of buildings, parking deck related, plaza deck related, big stuff.
Gotcha. So what were you doing?
Well, when I first came back, I was just on a crew working with a superintendent. And then from there, it's kind of been an evolution over my entire life.
Yeah.
I went from there to finally, once I understood enough about what was going on, then I became like an operations manager.
Okay.
Where I was responsible for gathering materials and going to job sites and making sure the guys had the products that they needed.
Your dad owned this business?
Yes.
Okay. Was it a successful business?
Very successful business, yes.
But when I say successful, like they were making good money and that was good.
Through the 90s, it was about a $10 million a year business.
Holy crap. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Okay. So how long did you work for him?
Well, off and on all the way through.
In this first stint?
There's so many going to work there and then for whatever reasons, dad and I just weren't seeing eye to eye. So I'd left and gone out and hustled some of my own projects. And I mean, that was early on. This is before I met my wife.
What made you want to go do your own thing? Because that's the biggest thing in business. Like, so you've seen it in the gym business. I've seen it in the food business. I've seen it in all these different things or landscaping where, you know, Kelly works for somebody. And then all of a sudden, Kelly thinks he can go do a better job on his own. What made you think, I want to go do something on my own?
It's just watching my dad.
Sure.
You know, I had the confidence that I could do it. You know, I wanted the freedom. I really, honestly, at a young age, looking back on it, I didn't know nearly as much as I thought I did.
Yeah. But
I always thought I could do this on my own.
When did you first realize that, like, you're not going to be able to work for someone else?
And I was young.
Really?
I mean, from the time I was a young kid, when someone would ask me what I'd want to be when I grew up, I'd say I want to take over my dad's business.
Did you really?
Very early.
Okay, so you knew that pretty quick.
I mean, I was just impressed by, you know, when we were in a group and there would be employees or any other people around, my dad always seemed to be like the guy that was in charge, and I wanted to be that.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
So when you left to go do your own thing, was your dad upset?
I think he was probably upset. He didn't necessarily, like, vocalize that to me.
Sure.
It was more like, go out and figure it out. And I think a lot of it was you gotta learn by experience.
Tell me about you starting your own business. Tell me about that.
I knew just enough about it to where I could go to a general contractor, a small general contractor, and just look for work and ask them, you know, if they had any type of waterproofing applications. And if you ask enough people, you're going to find something.
Find enough yeses.
Yeah, you find enough yeses. And I'm sure at that point in time, you know, being that I was basically a one-man show, my prices were probably low enough to where they were like, sure, I'll let you do that.
Yeah.
But there was one other job, though. I had a friend that was cleaning windows.
Okay.
And the waterproofing business has enough painting in it to where I felt like I knew how to paint.
Mm.
So he came to me. There was a house in Mountain Brook. He had cleaned their windows, and they needed somebody to paint the inside and the outside of their house. This is over on Brookwood Road. Big old house. I was like, you know, I can do that. So I went over there. I gave the guy a price. And that was my first real job where I had a contract to do it. And I learned a lot on that job.
Did you make any money?
Not really. There was
nope.
there was a phase of that project. The outside windows were the little pane windows. You know, we kind of on a handshake agreed we were gonna reglaze all those windows, and I'm talking hundreds of small little panes around the windows. And we got done. I didn't have an agreement in place, and I kind of got shortchanged on that one.
Okay, so we got waterproofing, we've got window painting. Tell me, like, that the amalgamation of all of those, like, in that early stages, what all did you do?
So waterproofing is kind of it's that category of jack of all trades, sort of like,
yeah.
when a building owner or property manager has an oddball project, like, you know, a concrete patch, or obviously there's a leak in the building, but that would involve like a sealant joint,
yeah,
wall coatings. You know, there's a number of epoxy injections. There's so many things that fall into the category of waterproofing.
Yeah.
You're the guy they call when they can't figure out who else to call.
But you grew the waterproofing company pretty good, right?
Yes.
How did you grow it?
When I was young, kind of the first, not the first stint, but one of the stints with my dad's company, he would require the people in the field to bring, this is back before we had email, to bring in addresses from various buildings. Whenever they're out and about, everybody was tasked with bringing in addresses to go into a database. And there was a girl, Jan, that was working in the office, who would take that information and compile it into a spreadsheet. And he would create these, I mean, beautiful flyers, not that flyers, mailers. And I'm talking about like 7 or 8 page mailers, 8x11, high dollar mailers. And they kept taking that information and compiling it into a database, and they would mail these out. That's how they were generating leads.
So he was generating leads through mailers, old school.
Oh, yeah.
So how did you grow the company?
Same way. Yeah. That evolved a lot with the data mining projects that I kind of mentioned. But mailers are what started
it. That's crazy. Did you ever transition? What was the other thing? Did you do anything past mailers to generate dollars there?
Well, that kind of evolved into emails.
So you said at one point you were doing $250,000 a month.
That was approaching the end. We were ramping up. That was when I got involved in the software development project.
Okay. So tell me. So let's transition to that. So we're doing a lot of money in this waterproofing business.
Yeah.
Why did you transition to software?
Well, I had to.
Why?
Because the transition to software happened after the bankruptcy happened. And that happened at the same time. Dad's company went under.
Okay.
And then shortly after that, so did my company.
Okay. So why did your dad's company go bankrupt?
It's just too much overhead. It had ground itself deep into a hole.
But they were doing $10 million a year. Like, tell me how does that happen in business?
The bankruptcy didn't happen until we got into the 2000s. Okay. Dad had extracurricular activities going on with women and things like that.
So he's just spending too much money.
Yeah. I mean, when you have CPAs and multiple accountants and a lot of overhead, it doesn't matter if you're doing $10 million a year. If you're spending 11, it can be any figure.
So he was doing well at the start, and then it just got out of hand as it grew. So tell me, so that was that him. So did you went through a bankruptcy process too?
But it was as a result of that.
I don't understand what you're saying. Like, you said that in the bio. Like, tell me, what is your dad's, his two separate businesses, what does your dad bankruptcy have to do with yours?
So let me give you the background on it.
Yeah.
So I moved to Atlanta right after I got married.
Okay.
So this was 1997. Worked with Southern Commercial Waterproofing for a year. Struck out on my own after that. And it was a slow build. I had built a client base because my primary job when I moved to Atlanta was to sell work. I mean, I had a clean slate. I didn't know anybody.
Okay, so let me stop. You work for your dad, and then you go to Atlanta to work for somebody else?
No, he had a branch office in Atlanta.
So you work in Atlanta, okay, and then you – okay, and that's your dad's office.
Yes.
And then you started working on your own.
Correct.
So you're working on your own, and that's in Atlanta, correct?
Correct.
All right, so keep going.
After a year, when you're selling, then you know the people
sure.
that are buying. there were some things going on in the company, middle management and whatnot, especially after I had started selling my own projects for the company, for my dad's company. So then I was intimately involved. And then when things weren't managed how I thought they should be managed, then I had something to say about it. You know, I wanted to improve that. I wanted my client to be taken care of.
When you're working for your dad.
Correct.
Okay.
And so my control over that was limited, and then it started to ruffle some of the middle management's feathers. I didn't like that. I wanted to be able to make those changes to improve the company so my customers were happy and they wanted to continue to buy from me.
So that's when you went and started your own deal?
That's when I went and started my own deal.
Okay, so tell me about starting that. And that's in Atlanta, right?
That's in Atlanta.
Okay.
I mean, I had the client base built up.
Yeah.
I knew I could sell additional work, so you know, I wasn't concerned about starving. My wife was a little more apprehensive about it.
Was Stacy working at the time?
No, we had Kelsey.
Okay.
She was a baby. I think Kinsey was just about to be born.
Okay. One income household, and you're starting this business.
One income, correct.
Okay. So tell me about like that, just that journey.
Yeah. So, you know, I immediately sold a project, like a good size project, Dick Simon Trucking. I still remember it was a big old concrete parking area, and they wanted to reseal all their control joints in the whole deck. It was like $15,000.
Okay.
But I was going to go out and do this work on my own. So my margins were great.
Sure.
I was only getting paid like $30,000 a year. So, I mean, we were off to the races immediately.
Yeah.
And then, you know, one job led to another, and, you know, I was really, really aggressive on going out and looking for the work. 'Cause in the commercial waterproofing field, in a lot of cases, you can go to a building and you can identify a problem, take a picture, find out who owns the building, send them a fax or give them a call.
Right.
You know, I've noticed this particular issue on your building. I'd love to give you a quote on it.
Yeah.
And that just began the process of drops in the pipeline.
How long did you own that in Atlanta?
So that started around 98, 99-ish, I think 98. Some of these years kind of run together a little bit. That's a long time ago. And then, I mean, we went all out in that. And then, you know, we started to mine data, build the database, and we started making our own 8x11 beautiful flyers.
So you're doing mailers, just like your dad was.
Mailers, trade shows,
okay,
cold calls.
Anything to generate business.
Anything and everything.
How long did you do that in Atlanta?
Well, we moved back to Birmingham in 2007-ish.
And so from 98 to 2007, you owned the business.
Well, the DataBridge was born right about the time that the bankruptcy happened.
Okay, so this story's getting really chopped up.
Yeah.
Okay. So you own the business. How long did you own the business in Atlanta, the waterproofing business in Atlanta?
Let me kind of put it in chronological order for you, make it a little easier. So in 2002, right after 9/11, Restoration MD was the name of the company. While it was kind of at its peak, where we were approaching that $250,000 a month in revenue, that was our highest month. So I don't want you to think we were doing $250,000 every month. We built it to that point.
Yeah.
I had a friend from Auburn, Brock Taylor is his name. He came to me he was a dot-commer. He had already gone out and raised some venture capital. And I mean, this is during the dot-com boom. And he came to me and he said, you know, I think we can get together and we can build a cloud-based construction management program and sell it. And
sell the program
sell the program. Like, we were going to develop software.
Okay.
That's what the project was all about. I still believe the guy was brilliant.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, yeah. He says, I'm all about it.
Yeah.
So he presented a contract and I showed it to my attorney, and my attorney said, don't sign that. But I didn't listen.
Why did he say not sign? Don't sign it.
You know, at that point in time, I thought that I was smart enough to make my own decisions, and I just didn't listen.
But why did he say not to sign it?
I guess because of the obligations it was putting me under or cash out of my construction business.
Okay, so was the construction business thriving at this point?
Construction business was thriving at that point, yes.
Okay, so you leave the construction business that's going good to go do this.
No, we're doing it at the same time.
doing it at the same time.
We were developing this software to utilize within my construction business, but also we're going to take it to
market.
You were
the pilot program.
Yeah. We were going to create. Okay. I mean, most everything that I've done has been done simultaneously with other things. Mm. Like, normally it hasn't been, all right, I'm going to shut this down and go do this.
You a lot of times had two different things going. Just like you had the gym and Birmingham Services here as of late.
And Battle of the Ages. Correct. All three going on.
Okay, so you're the waterproofing construction business is thriving. You've got this software thing going. And so you're trying to move in succinctly and growing the waterproofing business, piloting this software program. So tell me where it goes from there.
This was costing a pretty substantial amount of money. I mean, I had written three checks at least, two of them for $16,000, another one for $32,000, and this was to pay for development.
Okay.
So I had developers that had created the front end, and we were in the process of creating the back end, which was going to be basically like a QuickBooks Online type.
What is your partner doing? What's his skill set?
My partner, Brock. He wasn't really my partner. He was on retainer, but he was another business owner.
So you started the software company.
This was after the software.
Holy hell, Kelly.
Yeah.
I'm having a hard time tracking this thing.
Yeah, it's tough. The way the software company was born was through my experience from this previous software development project. Ultimately, what happened with the first software development project, which I didn't own the software company. They were developing this software for me.
Yeah.
I was paying them as a service. That came to an abrupt halt because even though we were doing that high of a volume in revenue, I was spending so much money to finance this project. And at the same time, I had heavy overhead. I mean,
so you're making bringing in a couple hundred thousand dollars a month, but you have a lot of overhead with the regular business, but then you're taking that money and funneling it into the software business. So at the end of the month, there's not much because you're running two businesses off of one business income.
Correct.
Rule number one, don't do that.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's bring this thing to like a tell me what's going on.
Okay.
Like, yeah.
I realized, so I was doing invoice factoring. I had a guy that I could take an invoice to, he'd give me 75% of it, and then when the invoice was paid, I would go to him, they'd take a percentage of that, and that was how I was...
That's how you're floating?
Cash flowing. There was another individual that was doing the same thing with this. This is just an individual. You know, he had a couple hundred thousand dollars, and he was trying to be the bank.
Be the bank.
Basically what he's doing.
Heck yeah.
Another fellow that he was loaning money to defaulted. So all of a sudden, he didn't have any more money to lend. And in commercial construction, it can be 60, 90 days before, you know, you
get your money.
Get the money from a project that you've completed. So here I am. I've got $15,000 a week in payroll or whatever it was, and I didn't have any way to produce money to pay it. So here's what happened. So I went back to Brock, who was the manager of the software development project, and I said, "Hey, man, so we're going to put this thing on hold for a while so I can accumulate some cash so I can continue to afford this." He didn't want to play that way. So next thing you know, I'm in a lawsuit. He's suing me, even though he already knew that I was cash poor. And so next thing you know, we're going through a lawsuit, which he sued my company and he sued me, which I put another $15,000 out to get my name out of the suit. And then that's the point where I went back to my dad, because dad was, you know, at office in Atlanta, office in Birmingham, office in Charlotte, North Carolina.
Oh, wow.
And in my mind, you know, that company was indestructible. That's what I had witnessed all my life. So I just went back to dad and said, "Hey, you know, I got a big backlog. I got a lot of projects going. And it seems like a perfect time for me just to
give it to you.
Come back to you guys and everything will be hunky-dory." For me, there was no due diligence because it really didn't matter what the state of the company was. But everything happened really fast. So we're like, okay, well, we'll do an asset purchase agreement, purchase all your assets.
Your dad's company.
Yeah, they purchased all my assets.
Okay.
They took on all my backlog.
All of work, which is a good thing.
All the equipment. And this was 2002-ish.
Okay.
That was short-lived. Within a year, Southern Commercial Waterproofing went into the Special Assets Division of South Trust Bank. They were trying to extend on a line of credit, which was already drawn out $1 million. And the bank, they didn't want to do it. So next thing you know, we have a CPA from South Trust Bank that's come in and has basically taken over the company.
Wow. So let me just bring this thing in. So like both of you, you and your dad both, were taking money from the business and spending it in other places, which in turn bankrupted both of you. You were spending it on the software business. He was spending it on other things, whatever those personal things were. Between the two of you, you bankrupted both of them. Is that
correct? That's correct.
You had a 90-day this deal with South Trust.
Yeah.
So you, both of you are, in essence, going bankrupt at the same time. Or you sold everything to your dad, and your dad's company goes bankrupt. This is what I'm understanding. So tell me about this 90-day thing.
So when Southern fell into special assets... Everything that
what does that mean, fell into special assets?
That's what the bank calls companies that are
in default.
Yeah.
Okay.
When you have a line of credit that's maxed out with the bank basically owns the business at that point in time. They come in and they protect their money in the best way that they know how. Pretty much they take over the bank account. I mean they come in,
gotta get the money back.
Yeah, well Dad became an employee of the bank. Here I am, pretty much dead in the water, other than, yeah, I still had all my client base out there. I still knew where to go and find work, but I didn't have insurance. I didn't have cash flow. I went to the bank and I basically, you know, just said, hey, I'm the guy that knows what's going on out there in the field, these various projects. I know how to use all the equipment, and I know how to get the work done. I want to purchase all the equipment and all the remaining assets of Southern Commercial Waterproofing. How do we do this without any money?
Wow.
So the idea was, is okay. So we put a number on it. It was like 150 grand at the time.
For all the equipment?
For all the equipment. I mean, you know, when something goes into special assets, you're paying 20 cents on the dollar.
Pennies on the dollar.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, we bought.
You pay 150, but how much is it really worth?
Yeah, I mean, it's worth more than that in a, you know, when you go out and piecemeal it.
Right.
They agreed. No, they really didn't have any better option. It was either going to be that or auction.
Okay.
And I got it before it went to auction.
Mm.
The way it worked is, one, I found a partner, a guy that had some cash. I went to the bank and I said, you know, let's do these projects and pay me this much and the rest of it will go to this purchase.
Yeah.
So they agreed to it. So okay, we'll give you 90 days. Every 30 days you pay us $25,000 a piece from me and my partner.
Mm.
We made our first payment. I did enough work and then we made our first $50,000 payment.
Wow.
And they gave us access to the equipment. I started moving and I consolidated everything to Atlanta. 7 tractor trailer loads of equipment. And God, I can't even tell you how many times I drove back and forth on flatbeds with trailers.
Right.
And you know, moved everything there. And this is where the previous software project gave me kind of the knowledge and the basis for what I did to start selling equipment. I knew that at that point in time, I needed a list of contractors.
Okay.
In Georgia, that were potential buyers for this equipment. So at that time, there was a website called the Blue Book of Building and Construction. It was kind of the early days of that type of application. A lot of it was where general contractors would go to like request bids for contractors. And I figured out a way that I could go in there and query that database. It would give me address and a fax number. Which at that point in time, the fax number was, that was the goal.
That was the email of today.
Yeah. So day and night, I was copying and pasting fax numbers into a spreadsheet and then loading that spreadsheet into a mass fax and sending out my inventory.
This is what I got for sale.
Here's the list.
So you're selling the equipment. You bought the equipment for $150,000 from the bank, but then you're selling it to other people. I thought you were going to start the business again.
Well, so there's more to it. There was a fella, his name's Pete Anderson, and he had worked for my dad previously, and he had a little waterproofing company there in Atlanta, and we were pretty good friends. I went to him and I said, "Hey, I'm doing this deal. I'm going to buy this equipment," and it wasn't just equipment. It was tons of leftover materials like coatings and caulking and
right.
anything you can think of where we could find a job and we could use it up, and we already owned the material. So that was just money straight in our pocket.
Right.
And he knew me and I guess trusted me. So he allowed me to use his company name. It's the Von Ryan Corporation. He allowed me to use company name, gave me a checkbook, opened up a separate account, and insured my jobs.
How about that?
In return, I let him use whatever equipment we need. I mean, it's a lot of equipment. So we had a lot of room to sell part of it and keep what we needed. So that's how the contracting business was continuing. The contracting business never went away. I just had to recreate the way that I got things done. Sure. So this is going on in the background. And it did for quite a while. I'll kind of circle back on where that ended. But that manual copying and pasting that I was doing and making those lists of fax numbers.
Yeah.
I had an employee that was with me at Restoration MD that kind of was involved and kind of saw this whole thing play out and knew about the software development project that I was doing with Brock
yeah.
in this process. Gave me a name of a guy. He says, "Man, you should meet this guy. His name's David Harris is the guy's name.
Okay.
He's a computer genius. Kind of a burnout, younger, but this is a kid that was developing and writing video games from like age 12.
Oh, wow.
His dad is the IT guy for the CDC in Atlanta. You know, brilliant
sure.
person. I said, "What do I got to lose, man?" I said, "Tell him to send me a resume." And guy sent me a resume, and I'm looking at it. There's all these different computer languages that he had taught himself out of books and whatnot. And I was like, "Come on in, let's meet." One August afternoon, this guy rolls up on his bicycle, pouring in sweat, 6'5". I'm sitting at my desk. He comes out. I'm like, "Man, this guy really wants to work."
Wow.
And so we're talking, he was going to do some construction out in the field. And also, I was going to pick his brain about this other computer stuff that I had going on. So I showed him what I was doing. I said, "This is how I'm making my database. This is how I'm blasting these faxes out here. And what can you do to help me?" And he says, "Well, I think I can write a scripting program that will automate the process of what you're doing manually right there."
Yeah.
I was like, "Man," I said, if you can do that. So it'd be awesome. I said, "Tell you what, I got $500. If you can do that for me and we can," and I gave him a block of data, and he disappeared for a couple of days, came back, and it was the first time I saw like a mass data import, and I didn't have to
copy and paste it. So you were like, "This is it."
I was like, I can do something with this. So in my mind, I was like, "Okay, if this works for selling equipment, if I can do this for selling commercial waterproofing service, or I knew I could.
Yeah.
And there about that time was when email was really starting to take off. There's email addresses. And so I began to research various professional associations like Building Owners and Managers Association, International Real Estate Management Association, International Facility Management. There's a bunch of them out there. I mean, there's a lot of associations where professionals,
right.
you know, they're members, and most of these associations produce a membership directory.
Mm.
So I would join, or a lot of it was just in the public domain, and I would go, and you could go query the database. And for instance, if I go to the International Real Estate Management Association, I query the database, show me all the property managers in Alabama.
There it is.
Here comes a screen. It says there's 260 property managers in Alabama, and there might be 10 of them shown. And then across the bottom of it, you've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, you know, you could
all
click,
the pages.
You could click through, correct. And you could click on a name, and then the data for that particular contact would show up on your screen, and you could copy and paste that data over into a spreadsheet and
correct.
Do the same thing that I was doing with the faxes. Well, we started writing scripting programs for that. I mean, we were pulling down that data, and when that data would come down, we had the idea, well, we're getting this data, and we started to realize that we could find email addresses in the blue book as well, in addition to those fax numbers. So we started going after the email addresses. And then as the facility management database started to build, we started marketing back to those contractors in various markets around the country. So we wrote this email that says, hey, we got a list of building owners and property managers that we can use for your company and produce leads. And people started buying into it.
So you started selling leads.
Started selling leads, selling spreadsheets, literally, all over the United States.
Were you making any money doing this?
Oh, yeah. That was how I sustained myself for several years. So
scraping databases, selling leads to whoever.
Whoever wanted to buy some leads. We made a bunch of samples. It wasn't Shopify.
Is this DataBridge?
This is the data. This is where the DataBridge, when that guy came to my office and created.
The big guy on the bike.
That's where the DataBridge was.
That's who
born.
You and him were DataBridge.
He and I were DataBridge, yes.
How long did that last?
That lasted all the way until I moved back to Birmingham.
So why did you move back to Birmingham? You were in Atlanta. Why did you move back
Kids,
to Birmingham?
We had gone through the bankruptcy, and we were just kind of struggling along.
Yeah.
I still had a lot of overhead. I mean, my house payment was almost $3,000 a month at that point.
When you say overhead, so you're doing DataBridge, but you're not doing the equipment business, the construction business, are you?
I am. Let me give you a little background on the construction business. So the DataBridge finally built itself to the point where I could sustain myself off the revenue that was coming from the DataBridge.
Okay.
But the Von Ryan Corporation was a big part of the financial stability of the Von Ryan Corporation was my partner's wife. She was a partner with Accenture. $250,000 a year salary, that kind of thing. And so his financials are what were putting us in a position to bid like bonded big projects.
Yeah.
He and I were on our way to the World of Concrete in Las Vegas, the first time I'd ever been there. And on the plane, she lets him know that she'd been having an affair. So everything kind of came to a screeching halt in that business. And we were paying ourselves a pretty good salary. He and I were...
But the business was doing good.
It was doing good.
So the concrete bid, the business, and DataBridge are going side by side. They're both doing well.
Correct.
So you're getting a good salary because you're not an owner. You're getting a good salary from the construction business, and DataBridge is doing well too. So things are good at this point. Have this situation with the construction with this guy's wife.
Yeah.
And then where does it go from there?
Yeah, it kind of came to an abrupt halt on that. Okay. I mean, we struggled. We didn't have the ability to bid the big work anymore. Plus, I mean, his mental game was shattered, you know. And so I saw the writing on the wall. I was like, this company's not going to be able to afford to continue to pay me this kind of salary and survive. So I bowed out.
So you're out of this business and doing just DataBridge?
Just DataBridge.
Okay, tell me where that journey goes.
Okay. So this is kind of where the...
So I'm going to ask this question. Do you feel like you have shiny object syndrome? Because this has got shiny object syndrome written all over it.
I think it was more of survival mode. I was waking up in the morning. I was enjoying it. I was having fun doing it. I don't feel like I was chasing a shiny object necessarily. I knew I was on to something.
Yeah.
The way we were getting this data was a little gray, like just because we were taking people's databases and making them our own. In a meeting I had with an attorney, he said, we can't really copyright people's contact information, but... You know, that would you put two attorneys in the room that are on different sides, they can argue that one all day long. Stacy was a little nervous about it. The Blue Book of Building and Construction showed up at my office one day and they're like, we're not really sure how you're doing this, because they had seeded some email addresses in their database, and they would get some of our email blasts. So they knew that somehow we had gotten their data. And they were like, you got to stop doing this. I'm like, well, stop doing it. I already got all your data. It was like 330,000 records. It was a lot. They had some things in place to try to limit your ability to query the database over and over and over again all day long. Mm-hmm. But I would just move from one IP address to another.
Oh, Lord. So you're getting super technical.
I mean, I'd go to Starbucks, mine until it stopped, go to another Starbucks. I mean, I was in Atlanta. IP address, keep going. Boom, boom, boom. And then that evolved into like 8 computers in my downstairs of my house that were working on different data mining projects. You were literally sitting there watching the computer go through these manual processes and watching these databases be built. I felt like a mad scientist.
It sounds like it.
It was awesome.
This is it's awesome. It's really, really technical.
The DataBridge became like a marketing service. Okay. So it went from just, I would sell a spreadsheet to anyone. But a lot of these contractors didn't know what to do with a spreadsheet when they got one.
So you sold the service.
So I sold the service, yes. So basically I would go and I'd find a landscaping company in San Francisco. And the pitch was, is you'll be our only landscaping company. So as our database grows, you're going to get the benefit of that. And we charge a monthly fee. And so I managed to build a client base that...
How many clients do you have doing this?
I think I got up to like 50.
Oh, wow. All paying a retainer.
All paying me a monthly fee. And
what were they paying you at the time? So this is middle early 2000s.
It varied. It just depends on how big the market was. Yeah. Like Los Angeles's database, I mean, the population, the bigger the population, the
bigger
more
the
data.
Retainer. Columbia, Missouri would be $400 or $500, what LA would be $4,000 or $5,000, something like that.
Probably more like 500 and three, you know. We weren't garnering that much money at that point.
Gotcha.
I mean, it was $500 a month for a Los Angeles account.
Oh, so that cheap at that point.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. So you were pretty vastly underpriced.
Probably.
Yeah. No probably about it. Yeah.
I mean, again, this was pre-2000. This was pre-9/11.
Yeah. Pretty cutting edge stuff for 99, 2000, 2001.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No doubt.
Okay, so tell me the journey of DataBridge then.
Okay, so the DataBridge, you know, we were seeking to be the marketing service for all different kinds of contractors and service businesses around the country. We did that. We were doing that. And in that process, I had a client in Long Island, New York, Ken Crowder, I think the guy's name, and the name of the company was TechClean.
Okay.
Their service was to go in. It's kind of like, you know, when you have a disaster happen, you got somebody come in to dry it out.
PuroClean, all those restoration companies.
Yes.
Yep. Okay.
He got together with some of his other service, you know, an epidemiologist, a law firm, the various companies that are involved in like disaster restoration.
Okay.
And they came to me and they were like, "Hey, we want to do a conference in New York at the Association of the Bar. You think you can sell tickets for us?" I don't know why not. Yeah. So
give it a shot.
Yeah. So Dave and I, we get together. We get our email marketing campaign. We got built a website, had all the information about the speakers and whatnot. We did all that. Started bombing out emails. People started signing up. This is a funny story. So our responsibility also was to make all the booklets for the handouts. And these were like, I don't know, 20 pages of booklet. Yeah. Not a lot, but when you have 100 of them. So he and I have papers spread out all over the basement of my house. And this is like in the middle of the night and we're supposed to get on an airplane the next morning. Oh, so I look at him and we're about halfway done. I'm like, "Man," I said, we're gonna have to pack all this stuff up and, you know, take it with us and put it all together in our hotel room the night before the thing." So we pack it all up. We drag this stuff on an airplane. We're in the middle of New York, you know, getting on a taxi and get it all put together, show up, do the event. And I mean, these people were like, they were blown away. I mean, they were like, "Man, you guys are geniuses." And we didn't make any money. My price was way too low. I think I got like $25 or $30 per attendee or something. And so I sort of real quick.
How many people were at the conference?
I mean, like 150. So,
oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So I made nothing.
Yeah, sure.
Other than just to be able to know that I could do it again.
Yeah.
Another guy surfaced from Los Angeles that owned, it was Paramount Restoration or something. The guy's name was Steve Slepcevic, Serbian guy. Because we were already doing some marketing for him. What we were doing for him is we would market in, because they're national contractors. They go anywhere in the United States to go and chase a storm. A storm happens, they go, and that's how they make money.
Yeah.
So we would market in an area for him for a while until we built up. They would do lunch and learns. Yeah. So we were spending the money to go to these areas and do lunch and learns, and we were helping them do that. I was like, "Hey, man," I said, "why don't, instead of doing these lunch and learns, why don't we change this up and do like a conference and actually charge people for that?" He was like, "Man, I like that idea." We did it. We built a disaster preparedness summit website. And had our first event at the Four Seasons Hotel in Los Angeles, California.
How about that?
And I mean,
sell it out?
I think we did sell that out.
Pretty close anyway.
I made a lot of people. I mean, everybody was really pumped up
about
it.
Did you make any money on this one?
Made a little more money. Still not enough. So we were kind of still working our way through that.
Yeah.
The cool part about that, though, was all the ticket sales were coming through me. So I was touching the money first. I wasn't satisfied necessarily with the amount of work that we were having to put in with what we were making. So that kind of started to evolve, which ultimately is what ended the relationship and the disaster preparedness summit, because there was really not an owner. This was just kind of one of those deals where and you have an idea and we start doing it, and there's really no corporate structure or, you know, who owns what.
Correct.
Who owns the website? Who owns the brand?
Right.
So then we started to kind of have our disagreements. But we had done, I can't remember how many events we'd done, but we'd done probably close to 15. I mean, we've been to Philadelphia. We've been to all the major cities.
All
we
major
started.
Cities. Okay.
I mean, I went all the way to Seattle for a disaster preparedness summit.
Yeah.
During the process of arguing over who actually owned it, they kind of went and built their own website and tried to strike out on their own on it and demanded that I give them a copy of my database. I was like, no, you're not getting that. And so that kind of fizzled out.
So where did you go from there? This is all DataBridge.
It's all DataBridge.
So where did you go from there?
Yeah. Well, that brings me to about the time where Stacy and I were deciding we were going to move on back to Birmingham. We wanted to reduce our overhead.
Sure.
Get around family. My whole family was here, but we were still relying on the DataBridge to survive, to feed us. So we set up a T1 in my garage. We bought a house in Birmingham, set up a T1, moved what we called the superstation into my house, and we were continuing.
What's a T1?
T1 used to be a big internet pipeline.
Okay.
I mean, it was mostly commercial at that point. But I needed the ability to send out mass emails, because we had taken that database and put it in a relational data, a SQL database, and had written our own HTML editor over top of it. So we could write and create emails, and then we could go in and query our sector of the database and send those emails.
So you need a big operation.
I could send like 80,000 emails a day at that point.
Wow.
And then, you know, you have to have the unsubscribe functionality and all that stuff. We had all that built in there.
How do you not let what happened in the other construction businesses happen in Birmingham? So how do you prevent the bankruptcies? How do you prevent the situations you had in the other businesses? How do you prevent that in Birmingham Services?
Man, you know, I think the biggest thing that I've learned, and especially in like the last 5 years, it's not about how successful I can make myself.
Mm-hmm.
It's about how successful I can make others around me. You know, I think that's been the struggle. Like, from my dad could have been retired 15 years ago.
Yeah.
But it's always been about his treasure chest. That's part of it, is just the investment into the people bank.
Yeah.
You know, people. I was undercapitalized when the bankruptcies happened.
Mm.
You know, I understand that it takes money to make money. You know?
You've got to have money in order to have, you've got to have money for the what if. And that's what I don't think people understand, is there's always a what if there. And it's different in the food business, in the construction business. You guys are net 30, net 60, net 90. We don't have that issue.
Yeah.
But we have times where like people don't do stuff.
We're not net 30 or anything like that in the residential market. We do a job and we get paid.
You get paid
immediately.
Which is a little bit odd. You have to have cash socked away somewhere for the what if.
Got to have cash for if you make a mistake, because you're going to.
Correct. That's another great way to say it.
Yeah.
And so being undercapitalized is the number one way that people fail in business.
Stay conservative. You mentioned the shiny object syndrome.
Yeah.
Well, maybe I had that when I was younger. Probably did. I mean, I wanted to go on all the fancy ski trips.
You did. Listen, we all have had it at some point in time.
Yeah.
If you're a business owner, you have the shiny object syndrome, because you always see, it's like the grass is always greener on the other side. Grass is greener where you water it.
Yep.
And if you can water your own thing, meaning like put forth the effort into that thing, that's where you're going to have the most return.
Absolutely.
Like, I've been guilty of it too. You know, I had to say no every day on some stuff. You know, we had a call yesterday with a guy that wants to start a fund. And I'm just like, I don't want to do that. Like, could we make money? Maybe. But like, number one, who are you working with? Massively important. Number two, is it going to splinter your focus? Because most of the time, if you splinter your focus too much, nothing's going to be totally great.
You're absolutely right. I mean, I was presented an opportunity recently for a piece of my dad's company.
Which company does he own now?
He's in the excavation business now.
Okay.
He's got his big equipment and I mean, Dad's kind of got the Midas touch. I mean, he knows how to make money.
Yeah.
And he's very tenacious.
It's really, really easy to make money.
Yeah.
It's really difficult to manage and keep money.
You're right. And that's where I go back to the people bank.
Sure.
You have to be a team builder. And if there's one weakness that I would say, and you know, a lot of the boomer era people, my dad's a Vietnam vet and that kind of thing, a lot of my way or the highway.
Yeah.
And that can be pretty abrasive.
Sure.
But there's power in a team.
Oh, no question.
You know. And, you know, for me, it's the same as you. I mean, that although that deal that was presented was somewhat generous, for me, the light bulb went off in my head. I don't want to get distracted. Because I'm already able to help that business because they do a lot of service for me. They do a lot of my demo. They do. So there's no reason for me to take on any additional risk.
Yeah.
And I can do, regardless of whether I own part of that business or not, I mean, eventually that may be the case, but right now the timing's not right. It's just, we have too much momentum. We have, I mean, just too many good things.
Did you get approached because they're in trouble?
They need sales.
But see, like that's a, to me, and I'm not questioning your debt, that's a red flag, bro.
It is.
That is a red flag. If he's got such of a Midas touch, I don't know your dad from Adam, but he's got such of a Midas touch, like why do they need sale? Like why are they having to bring you in when they, if everything is going good?
Usually when those opportunities start to present themselves, there's a definite immediate need.
Sure.
Because when everything is booming, then you don't think you need any help. But,
right.
You know, at 78, it's kind of his time to start to rest.
Wow.
And the company, you know, unlike my company, there's a good bit of overhead. I mean, there's an operations manager and accounting and all of these things. So there's still, at the end of the day, there's a lot of money going out the door. And then this equipment's not cheap. I mean, a couple million dollars worth of equipment, and not all of it's paid for. So every month, you know, there's
a nut every month.
There's that dough coming out.
Yeah,
that's not it. When you lay your head down at night to go to sleep when you're in debt, you're thinking about it.
Sure.
You know, right now, the way BM Services is structured, you know, we've capitalized ourselves. We've gone through we've saved our money.
That's great.
We've been conservative. We don't have a lot of overhead. Our equipment's all paid for.
Man, that's wonderful.
So
how much do you subcontract?
A lot.
Do you?
Yeah, I mean, I have my concrete finisher.
Yep.
I subcontract all of my finishing.
Okay.
Unless it's something small. I mean, Ryder and I and I have another Parker, young man that graduated from Alabama back in December that worked 4 summers in a row for me.
Okay.
So we're kind of the support crew. I mean, we make sure we got form boards.
You're at all the jobs. You're doing – okay, I understand what you're
on
saying.
On the job. Yeah. However we can support them. But concrete finishing is it's a skill. It's an art.
Yeah.
And my concrete finisher has been finishing concrete. We're almost the same age. He's been finishing concrete here in Birmingham for over 30 years.
Wow.
And I was trying to do, you know, pull together a few finishers, do this job, pull together a few finishers. Mm. As I had another guy before I met the finisher I'm using now. He passed away. And so it kind of put me in that position to where, you know, I had 10 finishers in my phone and that's how I would get it done. But we didn't have any kind of teamwork going on.
Yeah.
And I mean, I recognize, once I met Juan is his name, once I met him and I saw the way that he just carried himself and his experience, I was like,
Guy work exclusively for you?
No.
He does other stuff too. So this guy's busy.
Very.
That's good.
Yeah.
Good to have someone busy.
It takes a lot of pressure off me,
sure.
You know, because I'm not carrying a crew of guys that when I, you know, if we don't have a project or say we want to go on vacation.
Go.
Hey. We can shut our business down for 2 weeks and go do whatever we want to and then come back because these guys have plenty to do.
Sure. If someone wants to find you, Birmingham, they need something done, where can someone reach you?
It's easy. It's probably bhamservices.com.
Perfect.
It's Bham, the beloved.
Yeah.
Bham. Or call me. There's Bham Services.
That's the best way to get
me.
Perfect. Yeah. So if you need anything in Birmingham, concrete-wise, that's great. Hey, great job today. Thank you so much. A lot of lessons here. Goods, bads, trials, tribulations, and also some pretty, pretty hard hustle. So, Kelly, appreciate it.
Amen. Thanks.
Bye.